Good morning. Today is Friday, August the 16th, 2019, and the time is 8 a.m. I now call this meeting of the Finance Commission to order pursuant to Chapter 551 of the Government Code. There is a quorum with 11 members present. We'll move on to general comment. If there is anyone wishing to address the commission during the time of public comment, please fill out a witness affidavit form and bring it to the front. Public comments on non-agenda items are limited to 5 minutes and agenda items to 10 minutes. Do we have any cards?
No.
Members, item three, before we take up the consent agenda on items A1, B6 through B9, and D2 through D5 in a single vote, I want to state that any commission member may request that an agenda item be removed from the consent agenda and be placed on the regular agenda so it may be discussed and voted on individually. Hearing no objection from any members, do I hear a motion to adopt consent agenda items A1, B6 through B9, and D2 through D5 without discussion?
So moved.
Have a motion from Philip and
a second
from Molly. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion passes. Commissioner Cooper.
On the Finance Commission operations, just generally, all three agencies have been working diligently on their budgets, which were presented in a public meeting on Tuesday and then yesterday in the Audit Committee. And then also we have been dealing with the efficiency audit responses that was presented to y'all yesterday. And then other than that, it was business as usual.
Are we ready to go to item five?
Yes.
Okay. There are a few things better than an audit committee report at 8:05 a.m. So let's proceed. So, Molly, you had a audit committee meeting yesterday in the morning, and I understand that a lot of things were covered, and it went with some speed, so let's proceed.
Okay. The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the agency's 2019 third quarter investment officer reports.
Coming from the recommendation from the audit committee, no second is needed. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the agency's readoption of the investment policy. There was one addition to it, I believe.
Charles
on the banking. So we're making the motion to accept it with that addition that was presented to the audit committee yesterday.
So noted. Coming on the recommendation of the audit committee, no second is needed. Is there any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending's Information Technology Change Management Program audit reports as prepared and presented by McConnell & Jones, LLP.
Coming on the recommendation of the audit committee, no second is needed. Is there any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the Department of Savings Mortgage Lending's 2019 annual internal audit report as prepared and presented by McConnell & Jones, LLP.
Coming on the recommendation of the audit committee, no second is needed. Is there any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner's Information Technology Change Management Program audit report as prepared and presented by McConnell & Jones, LLP.
meal on the recommendation of the audit committee. No second is needed. Is there any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner's 2019 Annual Internal Audit Report as prepared and presented by McConnell & Jones, LLP.
Coming on the recommendation of the audit committee, no second is needed. Is there any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the Texas Department of Banking's Information Technology Change Management Program Audit Report as prepared and presented by McConnell & Jones, LLP.
Coming on the recommendation from the audit committee, no second is needed. Is there any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the Texas Department of Banking's fines, penalties, and restitution audit report as prepared and presented by McConnell & Jones, LLP.
Coming on the recommendation from the audit committee, no second is needed. Is there any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the Texas Department of Banking's 2019 Annual Internal Audit Report as prepared and presented by McConnell & Jones, LLP.
Coming on the recommendation from the audit committee, no second is needed. Is there any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the agency's 2019 third quarter financial statements.
Coming on the recommendation of the audit committee, no second is needed. Is there any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the agency's fiscal year 2020 operating budgets.
Coming on the recommendation for the audit committee, no second is needed. Is there any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes.
The audit committee would like to make a motion to recommend that the Finance Commission approve the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending's contribution of $750,000 to Texas Financial Education Endowment Fund.
Coming on the recommendation from the audit committee, no second is needed. Is there any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Record will reflect that the chair is present, not voting. The ayes have it, and the motion passes.
The audit committee would like to make a motion to recommend that the Finance Commission issue a request for a proposal to select an internal auditor for the Finance Commission agencies for fiscal year 2020.
Coming on the recommendation from the audit committee, no second is needed. Is there any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes.
That's the end of my request.
Thank you. Item six. The discussion of and possible vote to take action on the agency's priorities for fiscal year 2020 for the commissioners of the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending, Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner, and Texas Department of Banking. Do I have a motion to approve the agency's priorities for fiscal year 2020 for the commissioners of the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending, Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner, and Department of Banking?
So moved.
I have a motion from Stacy.
Second.
I have a second from Philip. Is there any discussion?
I have a question on it. I note that in the performance measures, we continue to have number of applications processed and, you know, number of complaints processed, et cetera. I thought we had a discussion at one point that those were kind of meaningless. It was more of a reflection of how did you do it within the time limits that, you know, did you process the complaint timely? Did you process the application within the number of days that you should. I can see where you could, the OCCC could make an estimate of how many applications just because of the type of licenses that you do, but for the Department of Banking or, you know, Savings and Mortgage Lending, you know, how are you going to know how many applications you're going to get for, like, a change of control or a branch or, I mean, it's kind of, to me, it was meaningless. So I don't know if you need that performance measure. I'm more interested, did you process the application timely? And we have those performance measures. So, I mean, I throw that out there. To me, it's a meaningless number. If you want to track it, great, but I don't see the purpose.
I would argue that or support that we leave them in. I think it's important context. I think it is important to track, again, how timely you are, but I think it's the context of are you doing 10 or are you doing 2,000? I mean, I think that's an important context that we have to consider in terms of, and it's an output measure, so it's just a workload indicator in essence. But that's really it's something that longitudinally we've been tracking for many, many, many years, and it's comparable to that measure for many other agencies as well. So I think it's important information, but I understand for your purposes it may not be quite as meaningful as others, but I think it does yield important context.
And just a comment, Molly, I guess I've always tended to agree with your position on that, but one of the things that's happened is, number one, I think the Sunset staff felt like it needed to be in there. So we did argue a little bit in that regard. But, for instance, on applications, we have to project where we are or where we think we would be in order to properly staff that function. And we track that number, and it's not a really good indication of performance, but it is an indication of activity, and so I think it probably needs to be in there too. And as far as whether they're timely or not, obviously we have to try to deal with that, but each application kind of stands on its own and could be timely. It could be adjusted. I guess we could come up with something like that, but anyway, I think what we have in there is other agencies do deal with it, and so it's kind of a comparison. My two cents.
Yeah, and I would agree. And even though there's not a measure about our timeliness with applications, we certainly internally make sure that we're timely, or if not, that there is an extenuating circumstance with that particular application.
May I offer a compromise that possibly is that we will look at, as when we do our reports, we'll maybe include that in our reporting.
That would be great. I think it's helpful. That would be great. Yeah.
Right, Mark?
Absolutely. Any other discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion carries. Possibly we'll take items 6 through 10 in executive session. Let's go on to the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending. Commissioner Jones.
Yes, certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Savings and Mortgage Lending starts on page 43. Okay, so starting with the thrift industry, as of June 30th, 96% of the state savings banks were well-rated with one formal enforcement action. Under charters and mergers, first on the growth side, Spirit of Texas SSB has publicly announced a definitive agreement to purchase Citizens State Bank Tyler. That purchase will increase Spirit of Texas's assets by approximately $349.1 million, and we are expecting to receive that application in the next couple of weeks. And we have received notice that two state savings banks have filed applications to convert to state commercial banks. One is Next Bank, SSB. The other, I've been informed about, but I don't feel at liberty to state its name. It's a smaller one. But with the exit of those two institutions, we remain comparable to where we've been historically with assets in the system, as assets will be $17.1 billion. We are aware that this will impact the agency, and we are already developing a plan. When the conversions are effective, we will finalize our analysis, adjust accordingly, and submit a revised budget to you all. And we will make sure that that budget provides for the thrift industry to be self-supported. So
could you characterize the size of that institution compared to your others?
Of the one that I can't name? I want to call Stephanie Trotty to the table. She'll know exactly. And I don't think by giving that number it would be identifying. Would you agree?
It's public.
It is public now. Oh, okay. Well, may I say? Well, so it's Interstate Bank out of Perryton. And
Stephanie Trotty, Director of Thrift, and it is about $171 million in assets, so it is one of the smaller institutions.
So I've included it into that loss with resulting in the 17.
Okay. Thank you.
Certainly. Okay. Lastly, under Thrift Industry Day is September 12th. You all have received an invitation, and we would welcome any of you who want to attend. Moving on to the mortgage industry, the current licensing population is in the book, so I won't read you those numbers, but I do want to give you a comparison to a year before. So this chart is as of July 30th, 19. As of July 30th, 18, the entity number was 1,968. The branch number was 3,554. And the individual RMLOs was 28,778. With regard to the mortgage call report, now the call report numbers are all submitted by the licensees. And so this gives you a comparison of the total amount of loans, the number of loans, and the average loans, comparing calendar year 17 and 18. Those numbers are comparable. Looking at calendar year first quarter of 19, it's maybe a little less in some areas, but roughly comparable as well. Under mortgage examinations, 381 through third quarter this year, 333 through third quarter last year, and comparing the number of individual licensees covered last year, 7,922. And as I've been reporting to you all through the year, this year we examined more smaller mortgage companies, and so they have fewer mortgage licensees, individual mortgage licensees. So that's an expected change from what we did last year. Under consumer complaints, through third quarter, we had received 727 consumer complaints. As of May 31st, 59 were open. 93% of those open had aged 60 days or less. And as no surprise to anyone, said that most of those had to do with loan servicing, which was 73%, most of those being escrow issues or payment disputes. We do several in-house mortgage examiner trainings a year as one of our methods to provide professional development and education. We did our last one during July and brought in several outside speakers to talk to our examiners. Two of them, Marty Green from Polensky, Beidle & Green, and Scott Gillen from Stewart Title, talked about electronic mortgages. And I've talked to you all before about giving you information about the evolution of electronic mortgages in across the country, Texas in particular. So that was one of the items that we wanted our examiners to hear more about. And I want to give you just a couple of the pieces of information that we received during that training. In 2019, there was an increase in activity in electronic note-only transactions and an increase in warehouse lenders who currently are ready to fund e-notes. In 2015, there was only one warehouse lender who would fund electronic notes. Today, there are 19. Ginnie Mae and Federal Home Loan Bank do not, as of yet, although they both have initiatives to do so. Those are in progress with no necessarily target end date that I know of, but they are in progress of figuring out how to do that for themselves. in their shops as well. Then with regard to measures on page 47, as of third quarter, we had met or exceeded all our measures. Under internal operations, the administration staff, as required, submitted our records retention schedule to the state Texas State Library. Staffing turnover on page 49, during the first three quarters, we had four separations. Two were interagency transfers, two were voluntary resignations, and of those voluntary resignations, one was a financial examiner who went to the private sector. And August 1st, we have a new attorney named Ian Berry, and you will meet him at another meeting. He is at training today. So. And then under departmental operations, Stephen O. Shields was elected president of TSAABA, which is the Texas State Agency Business Administrators Association, and we're glad to have him in that position in state operations. So congratulations to him. And I am welcome any questions before I turn it over to legal. Okay, Ernest.
Good morning, Ernest Garcia, General Counsel of the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending, along with Devin Wills, Associate General Counsel. I'm going to touch a little bit about legal activities, and then Devin will go into the rules if there aren't any questions. As referenced on page 50 of your materials, there are no current pending judicial court cases, which is a good thing. As far as contested SOA matters, there have been no contested hearings since the last Finance Commission meeting. I might add that is often the case that we would report that. One of the things the legal department does, certainly among others, is when we get referrals from investigations, we prepare orders for Commissioner Jones' consideration. Orders go out, covering a wide variety of things. In many cases, the individuals will not dispute the order. In other cases, they will appeal, at which point legal will have to schedule the case for SOA. And then after that, it's anybody's guess. A lot of those cases will resolve themselves not too far into the contested process. But then some of the more complicated matters, certainly those involving multiple parties, oftentimes involve a tremendous amount of work with respect to not only discovery, but pre-hearing motions and so forth. We have to treat every case that gets appealed and scheduled before SOA as if it's going to go to a contested hearing, and we prepare each case as such. But the vast majority of them will resolve themselves. And oftentimes they don't resolve themselves until the eve of the contested hearing, which is why you don't see us reporting on a whole bunch of those very often. I will say, though, that the one in the material that I do reference is one that is coming up in a few days, and that involves the department versus a originator by the last name of Balut. That'll occur in a few days here. And that's one where the department, although some of the discussions have been ongoing, and I certainly can't divulge those, this is a situation where the department feels fairly strongly that the individual's license should be revoked. And this is a situation where we believe the evidence will show that the individual on the heels of a closing, that the licensed originator kicked back or paid money to the borrower. We feel very strongly that that is extremely detrimental to the integrity of the loan origination industry, the mortgage industry, and consumer confidence, aside from the fact that it could lead to a gross competitive disadvantage if one individual is not compliant to the laws about that, and everybody else is. So that is one, and although, again, like consistent with the other matters I reference, although some of the discussions are always on the table, it's one we have not been able to reach any agreement on, and I feel fairly confident we won't be able to reach an agreement on. We are pretty firm with seeking revocation, and they're pretty firm of wanting to continue to do business. So
Ernest, if you don't settle, what is the sort of timeline or next steps in that proceeding?
Well, so if there is no settlement, and the case goes forward, you have the hearing, then the ALJ has 60 days to do a proposal for decision. The proposal for decision then comes to Commissioner Jones for her review, and she can either approve the proposal for decision or reject it or modify it. I would say in the vast majority of the cases, I believe Commissioner Jones has historically approved of the proposal for decision from the administrative law judge. If, for whatever reason, after all of that, and there is, in quote, a final order from the department, if somebody is not happy with that, whether it's the department or the other individual or business, then they can seek to appeal it in a judicial forum before the Travis County District Court. And then that can take however long that takes.
I know it's hard and difficult to estimate times. Is the process you just described a year from now or to get to the district court, or is it less than that?
So when we have cases that go before the Travis County District Court, from the time they're filed till the time of resolution, I would say is easily going to take about a year. Even those that I think are fairly straightforward. You know, the most recent one that you all may recall I reported on was a matter where the department had not one but two final orders for an entity known as VPW and Associates out of the Dallas-Fort Worth area to cease doing business. And this was an entity that existed in their internet only and would offer to do loan modifications and would accept people's money but would never do any work. And that's a, you know, if you can get away with that business model, I guess it's good. You get, we had one consumer that had paid like $10,000 and got zero other than a foreclosure. And this couple also had a special needs child. It was devastating for them. That's just one that we were aware of. So that's a case where we just said, okay, we have orders in place for them to stop doing this. Of course, we had one order that told them to stop doing it, and they kept doing it. And now we have a second order to stop doing it, and it looks like they're still doing it. So sometimes people don't fully respect, I guess, an agency's final order. And so that was one that we ended up, well after the SOA procedure, referring to the AG's office for further action. And even that, you know, took a year just to reduce it to a judgment.
Thank you.
Two questions kind of on the same line. Going back a little bit, when you first described it, it takes at least a year. So they're able to continue business during that time period. Is that correct?
Well, and so when I say it takes at least a year, it certainly does with respect to cases, say, going to the Travis County District Court. With respect to SOA cases, it really runs the spectrum. We're mindful of the fact that while we're attempting to do something like revoke somebody's license, they still get to do business. And so we attempt to try to have those hearings as soon as possible. SOA judges, similar to other judges, though, are receptive to continuances for one reason or another. And so sometimes person that appealed our order will say they have an illness in the family or some issue or another. But yes, you're right. In those instances, those individuals continue to do business until we get a final order that says they've got to stop doing business.
And then in this particular case you made reference to,
yes, sir.
Did they have an option to do a fine or something and go forward or not?
An option to do what?
To like be fined and then go forward. Say, okay, we'll stop doing that. Do they have an option other than get their license taken away?
So yes. The statutory provisions provide, when it comes to disciplinary actions, the statutory provisions applicable give the commissioner a range of things that she can do, revocation certainly being more on the serious end of things. Administrative penalties are an option as well. You know, there are other instances where we can reprimand or admonish. So not every situation involves a penalty, and certainly not every situation is extreme with respect to revocation. Now, if you're wondering, and I apologize, maybe I'm anticipating maybe what your question or follow-up question might be, but if you're wondering, well, so why is the department, taking this stance with respect to this individual, or has the department explored other options? Again, without going into the details of settlement negotiations, which are not public information, I can say that this individual, this reference in the materials, was also the subject of prior order. In the prior situation, again, the department felt like there was a kickback, money-back situation. The parties reached an agreed order that had a financial penalty. And I will say that one of the reasons for that was because in that situation, the individual argued that, well, in that transaction, I was actually wearing two hats. I was acting as a realtor, and I was acting as an originator. And realtors give do kickbacks. And so that's really what it was. We didn't feel that way. But again, given the facts and circumstances of the case, and this was the first time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, there was a penalty situation and other aspects in that order. And it was really crystal clear that if the person had forgotten their ethics training, if the person had forgotten the requirements of getting a license, if the person had forgotten the laws that apply to kickbacks, we made it real clear that they knew it as a result of that prior order. And, of course, we felt that maybe a penalty in that situation would, in fact, accomplish its task, and that is serve as a deterrent to future violations. In this situation, one hat. Can't say you were doing a realtor kickback or whatever. You were just serving as an originator. Pretty sure there's less ambiguity in this case. So, yes, we do explore situations where there shouldn't be. We explore situations where there should be a penalty and the extent and the severity of it, and we have a matrix for that we adhere to. And then we feel like, okay, if there's a situation where there's very little gray area here. And the other thing is, again, what is the type of violation? Is it more of a technical violation, a documentation type of violation? But the one that I'm referring to here, I believe the department is of the position that really goes to why SML exists. Because there's a set of rules there that everybody's supposed to play by, and it's to protect consumers and protect the industry. And I think what this individual is doing, and we believe the evidence will prove it, is that this is something that really goes to the heart of what SML regulates. And we And given the facts and circumstances and the history that the department has had with this individual regarding a very similar situation, we feel like a penalty would be inadequate. Sir.
All right. I have no follow-up question.
That means you're tired of listening.
No, no.
And that, sir, is not the first time I've heard that.
Good job.
Are there any other questions that I might be able to answer before Devin tackles the rules?
Questions, members? Okay. Devin, I noticed that you took the good chair and left others to the other chair, and I think that's pretty brave of you, but good luck with that.
I think, sir, if I may, it's because he's probably going to be seated there longer than I might be, and he needed something comfortable.
Good response. All right, sir, we have, we've taken up four rules on consent, so now we're on to item number five.
Good morning, commission members. Item number five is the adoption of Chapter 52.
Say your name and agency. Yeah.
Devin Wills, Associate General Counsel, Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending. Item number five is the adoption of a new Chapter 52 concerning Department administration, particularly complaints and complaint processing. This was a recommendation of the Sunset staff that we formalize our current complaint procedures into rule, and that with a few minor changes. We did receive one comment. It is and the comments and it's summarized in your materials as well as our responses. Generally speaking, regarding the comments, since we only received one, I was able to reach out to the commenter and go over their concerns in detail with her. And after we spoke and had some follow-up emails, we had addressed the vast majority of her concerns. And wasn't necessarily opposition to the new rules, just some concerns and seems after our discussions, we were mostly in agreement. If you have any questions regarding the proposal or the comments,
do you send a response back to their letter in writing, or is it like in the preamble of the discussion regarding comments that were made, blah blah blah?
I didn't send a formal written document, but since there was, I guess the formal would be in the materials here and in the which eventually would be posted on the Texas Register. But since there was only one, I was able to speak with her directly and go over them in detail. Okay. Any other questions?
So I am suffering from a little confusion here, and it's not your confusion; it's my script's confusion. This is an adoption of the rule.
Yes.
And my script is a proposal for publication, so I'll need to modify my thinking.
Would you like my?
Yes, I would. Thank you. This is item five. Do I hear a motion to approve on final adoption new tax seven, new seven tax part four, chapter 52, Departmental administration, subchapter A, complaints, subsections 42.10, 42.11,
52.
Pardon me, yeah.
Yes.
52.10, 52.11, 52.12, and 52.13 concerning complaints and their processing, resolution, disposition, review, and reporting.
So moved.
I have a motion from Stacy.
Second.
I have a second from Hector. Is there any discussion? Devin, let's go to page 55 in the book. This is 52.11, subsection D, which is the department will make a good faith effort to protect complaints' identity to the extent practical. Is that, you know, there's a lot of issues in the public today about the confidentiality of information, and a good faith effort to protect to the extent possible. Not sure how that standard can be. Is there an industry standard for protection, do you know? Or?
Well, that would be the, I guess, the specific language recommended by Sunset. It's a general, I guess, broadly applied to all the agencies. But regarding, I guess this would sort of encompass the specific standard for these type of complaints. Seeing as it's a general, when specifically applied to the this industry or these industries, it generally would be very difficult to not reveal the identity in that someone's complaining about a specific loan, a specific entity, so we couldn't really, in most cases, speak with that entity without letting them know who the person is who is complaining and what specific file they're complaining about. But there are situations where it would be appropriate to protect the identity, such as if there's a whistleblower, and we have done that when that occurs.
So you'll have processes in place that will make sure we do that. And
yes.
Yes.
That was one of the provisions that was commented on, and I explained to her the laws governing Texas open records and public information. I guess a brief summary would be that any document in a government agency the default is that it's public, unless a statutory exemption applies, such as protecting confidential information. We're obviously not going to be publishing Social Security numbers or credit card numbers, things like that. So whenever essentially someone would request a document from the agency in writing, it would be reviewed by a public information officer here, potentially by an attorney, and we would see what provisions, what protections applied, and then we would send it to the Attorney General's office, and they would do an additional review and make a ruling on what had to be protected and what had to be disclosed, and we would only disclose that which we were told we had to.
Okay, thank you. Any other discussion, members? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes. On to item 10.
Item 10 is regarding a new section 81.110.
What page are we on?
75. This would be implementing requirements of Occupations Code Chapter 55 regarding licensing military service members, military veterans, and military spouses, particularly as they relate to residential mortgage loan originators. I guess broadly speaking, this chapter makes it easier for current military members, veterans, and their spouses to get licensed, such as an active member was transferred to a base in Texas and they had a spouse who was a licensed originator, that they wouldn't have to go through the full process. Essentially, we would give them, deference to their license in another state so that they could get started right away in the industry rather than going through the full process. It would be for a temporary period. The others are dealing with someone who had training or experience as an RMLO in the military, that we would give credit to that as well. These are just many of those statutes say that we shall implement rules to implement those statutes. So are there Any questions regarding these?
Members, do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment?
So moved.
New 7 TAC Part 4, Chapter 81, Section 81.110, concerning licensing of military service members, military veterans, and military spouses.
So moved.
I have a
second.
Motion from Vince and a second from Laurie. Is there any discussion? Devin, let's go to page 77. In the second column, there's item D, the expedited licensing procedure. I don't know whether this is a question to you or Caroline, but sort of how do they get moved to the front of the queue? I don't quite understand that process. So.
And that, perhaps that's a Stephen of Shields question,
yeah.
Stephen.
Okay.
Can you?
I just don't understand how that happens.
Right.
So.
Yeah. That's pretty
obviously, this is Stephen of Shields,
name.
The Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending. They have to notify us that they are.
Yeah, but once they do, let's say you know who they are. By the way, my Uber driver yesterday was really excited about something like this because he just moved to Fort Hood, and his wife is a teacher.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
Apparently the TEA has a similar responsibility. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, rather than waiting forever, she's going to get to start teaching now.
That's exactly. That was the intent of the bill, that these rules are implementing.
So
the bill that passed this year.
So this is cool. I'm just trying to figure out procedurally how you get moved to the front of the queue if you're a military person.
I mean, again, upon the notification that they are meeting the criteria, we would take those people out of order and process their application at that point.
So it's just simple as that. You know it, mm-hmm. and then you'll just move them to the front of the queue.
Yes.
Thank you. Any other questions? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes. Thank you, Carolyn.
Yes, thank you. That is, unless there are any questions about anything else, that concludes our report.
Mr. Pettijohn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our report begins on page 83. I don't have a lot of sort of industry and economic news briefs for you this morning. Recent volatility in the marketplace sort of introduced some new questions. There was some data released by the Federal Reserve on August the 6th that was reporting on the total consumer credit outstanding in June. And that has expanded. Total consumer credit in the U.S. has expanded to $14.6 billion in June. That total is the sort of smallest increase over the past 3 months. It's a bit lower than the median estimates that certain economists have made. But the gain is attributed exclusively to large increase in non-revolving credit, which includes auto financing and student debt, student loans. You know, we'll see kind of what happens, but there's some concern about how consumers may be approaching debt amid some of the recent economic uncertainty and the high volatility. So we'll see whether that softens and consumer softens spending. So there's some other opposing indicators that still suggest that consumer confidence is fairly strong, so we'll be watching those numbers, and we'll talk again about that in October. Moving on to page 83, you'll see a report on the examinations conducted September through June, and we are on track to surpass our goal for fiscal year 19. Very pleased with the progress of the exam team. There's also some comments in there about the work that the senior leadership of the exam team has been taking on regarding to enhancing the development and quality and consistency of our training and moving, continuing to develop examiners in a number of different ways, and we're certainly pleased with how that's progressing. On page 84, you'll see the report on license types with acceptable level of compliance, and in this particular chart as of June, you'll see all five groups above 85%, which is our acceptable level, but I want to sort of put a bookmark here to expect a significant decline in cap compliance in the fourth quarter. That's coming. We know that's coming. And when you look at the trailing 12-month chart on the bottom of page 84, and you see where the cap compliance has remained in the 50 to 60%, it's probably not going to climb
so
much.
So when I penciled in my little celebration emoji,
yeah,
it's going to go away.
It's going to go away. It's going to go away, yeah, I'm afraid. So we'll continue to deal with that, but we're seeing some significant issues of compliance in that marketplace, and we'll continue to work on that. On page 85, information on investigations and complaints. On investigations completed, you'll see that we've performed 67. 33% increase in the investigations so far this year have been in motor vehicle sales finance. We do expect to end the year at our goal in terms of the number of investigations completed. In terms of complaints processed, this activity is fairly stable year over year by comparison. You see the new information on the non-jurisdictional complaints that we're now reporting to you. In terms of the categories of complaints, we're seeing about a 10% increase in motor vehicle sales finance. And, of course, they still rank in the number one category, and there are about 63% of the complaints that we process. And then the cab complaints are in the second category of complaints that we deal with, and they're about a little over 8% of the complaints that we deal with are from credit access businesses. Moving on to page 86, just information on the breakdown of those complaints. Happy to answer any questions or call upon staff to answer questions related to if you have detailed questions about the categories of complaints. And then the ratio of complaints, we see similar information, similar ranking. Property tax lenders is up at the high level, but that's typically because of the denominator. The population is so small that tends to place them any measurable number of complaints tends to place them up fairly high on that ratio. Moving on to the licensing report on page 88, we have just concluded the motor vehicle and commercial motor vehicle sales finance license renewal period. We estimate we have about 87-88% of our licensees that renewed. Most of those were submitted online, which we're very grateful that we've been driving traffic to the online portal. I think that's more efficient for all folks involved, and so we've been pleased by that. It certainly resulted in really high call volumes during the renewal period, because I think we were more of the IT support desk trying to help people through that had questions related to the renewals, but we're pleased at the rate of adoption of the portal. Application processing, we are working hard on implementing the sunset legislation related to the upon employee licensing and the movement from the required license to the pawn shops being able to opt in to licensing. And so we are making modifications to our systems to accommodate that, as well as preparing for shifts in the volumes that we will see and how we might shift our resources to deal with those issues. I think it'll take some time to work through that transition. It's not going to be an immediate effect, but because licenses have just been renewed in June, and those will extend till the following June. So, but we'll certainly begin to see some effects of that moving forward. If you look on page 89 as the dashboard of the regulated entities, and you'll see we're at some peak levels. Again, this data is presented before the renewal period, and we typically see some attrition through those renewal periods. So you'll see the motor vehicle sales finance licenses in the upper left corner is up at a high point of 9,568. We'll see that dip a little bit because of the numbers that did not renew. On the upper right corner, you'll see the number of pawn shop employee licenses up to a new all-time high of 9,600. But again, that dip is going to be more significant over time, as we estimate somewhere probably around in the 2,500 range, maybe, is what our new total may be in terms of number of licensed employees. But we'll see how that works out. And then on the lower right, you'll see the all regulated entities again at a new peak of 37,412 total regulated entities, individuals and entities. Moving on to the administration report on page 90, you'll just see we've been fairly busy this summer out with a number of the trade associations and a number of the groups, and there's a lengthy list of presentations that we've been involved in this over the last couple months. And so we really appreciate those opportunities and enjoy getting out and visiting with the regulated community and consumer groups and trying to provide information and be available. And those are always very, very fruitful discussions and enlightening. And moving on to HR, there's a position posted here, noted here, that is a program specialist. This is our financial education and grants specialist. I mentioned this yesterday in the audit committee. We regret that we had a couple of separations, and Deandra Sullivan has left us to go to the University of Texas at Arlington to work on grants, and Juan Garcia has left us. I think most of y'all were aware of that. He probably sent you an email. So we certainly are sad about those departures, happy for those folks that have new opportunities that have presented to them, but we're certainly working quickly to try to fill this financial education and grant specialist, because it's a pretty critical time for the endowment program as we have applications open and are looking into the next grant cycle. You'll see information related to turnover and separations. That's sort of normal, I think reasonable given the economic period that we're in right now. You can answer questions on that if you have that. I also, on page 92, is a report on financial education, and we're certainly on track to meet our in-person financial education delivery goals. We're, in fact, nearly at the annual goal already. But I wanted to comment on this new project that came out of House Bill 35, and House Bill 35 required that the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner and the State Securities Board work together with the Department of Family and Protective Services to help combine some resources and update this guide that's delivered to aging out foster youth. And so we worked with those folks to help develop this basic life skills and social skills guide. We think there's some good information in that. Hopefully it will get used. and will be of use and benefit. So we'll continue to talk to those folks and see if there's more opportunities, but I think that's a really deserving population that we would like to get better financial education into their hands. And so we were pleased and proud to work on this project and hope that it will be very useful. moving on to page 95, this is just some of the data information on performance, but there's one measure that's really you don't see very often. It's really only reported in this report, but that's the money's return to consumers as a result of our examination activity and other activity, and you'll see that's the very top item on that page 95, and we're at currently at $14.47 million in restitution that's been delivered to consumers this year as a result of the activities of the agency.
Is there a predominant industry that comes from?
That's still predominantly coming from the motor vehicle area.
What's the nature of the
I'll have to call upon staff to give you some more detail. William, are you able to shed some light on that?
William Purse, Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner, Senior Review Examiner, or Senior Supervising Examiner now. Where we see most of the restitution for motor vehicle dealers comes from excessive public official fees for tax, title, and license, where they charge more than they're legally allowed to charge. Excessive inspection fees, where they charge an inspection fee, but they actually do not conduct the inspection of the motor vehicle. We see as unauthorized fees, where they charge fees that wouldn't be authorized by statute, like a lender processing fee, administrative fee, unauthorized service contracts, where there is authority to authorize a service contract through the Texas Occupations Code. They have to be licensed or registered with TDLNR, and they do not have the proper authority to offer that product. So those are generally what we see are overcharges. I don't know if anybody's got any questions.
Do you see a trend? And are more of those happening, less? Is it about steady? Because the number's up, so.
Well, I think some of it also has to do with expedited payment fees and debt cancellation agreement fees is probably where a significant portion of those restitutions occurred. And so I would say those numbers, we're starting to see a trend where we've gone to most of the acceptance companies. And so we are starting to see their compliance improve after the first examination. And so typically that change has been made in 2011. And we've gone through the process of going to conduct those examinations of those acceptance companies. And there were some changes that were made to the statute to make their understanding of where they had to do for the refund of the unearned debt cancellation agreement in 2017 to be clearer. And so I think that has and will have a reduction in that kind of restitution that would be necessary.
So what I'm trying to get my head around is, we have in front of us, and unfortunately you don't have the numbers right in front of you, but we have fiscal year 2017 at 20, and then last year at 5, and now year to date we're at 14. And so I'm just trying to get my head around the basis for the variability.
Well, and this number has always had great variability in it. These tend to be larger refunding projects that we find, and it may just be because a particular program was implemented following some legislation, and there were issues associated with it, and it just happens to be the year in which we conduct the examination or the year in which they complete the restitution project, and we are able to confirm it. And there's just some timing that I think kind of affects it, but it is a fairly volatile number, but I don't think there's any other trend that we're concerned about. It's some of the same types of issues that we've been seeing consistently over the last 5 or 6 years.
Typically, those refunding projects take several years to complete, and so we may have initiated the examination several years ago, but it's taken them some significant amount of time to be able to go through their records in order to provide that restitution. I mean, currently we have two large acceptance companies that have been working on the project for about 2 years now, and I would assume they would complete that in 2020 for that project. But I think a lot of it had to do with implementations and changes they made in 2011.
Okay. I was just trying to tease out a trend.
Yeah.
So these are primarily used car resellers?
No, not necessarily. I mean, it could be buy here, pay here dealers, but a lot of these may be more acceptance companies and franchise, new car sales. But it could be both. It's not really one or the other. And it's been a while, but we've looked at some of the trends on restitution, and really it was sort of equal across all segments. There's not any particular one versus the other.
And so it requires an individual turning in a complaint for this to surface?
Not necessarily. This could be that it was discovered during an examination.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, William.
You're welcome.
Okay, moving on to page 96 is the performance measures, and this is the third quarter report of performance measures. And you can see that we've met or exceeded 5 of 6 of the measures. The one measure not met is the number of complaints closed, and we're not going to meet that measure. We know that the level of complaints is going to be a little more consistent with fiscal year 17. And we have adjusted, it seems that there's overall a little bit of drop in the number of complaints, and we're going to adjust that target going forward. As we just did in the priorities earlier, we're going to adjust that down a little bit more comparable to our experience over the last year or two. But otherwise, everything else is met or exceeded. And I think that's all the operations information. I think we're ready to go to the legal report.
Can I ask a question? Sorry to interrupt you before we move on to that. And I apologize, I was not at the grant committee meeting, the audit committee meeting yesterday, so this may have been discussed and I didn't get to hear that. But with Deandra and Juan both leaving, what was Deandra's? Was she a specialist 3? Was she a 4? What was
she? Was a program specialist 1 or 2.
Okay. And you've got 3 posted. Do you anticipate any delay in the grant process?
No delay in the grant process. As I mentioned yesterday, and I'm happy to share that, thanks for bringing it up. We've got some folks on staff that I think that have some very good skills and talents associated for this project. Christine Graham and Kimberly B.O. are both involved in this and picking up some of the activity related to this. Nancy Ebert will also be assisting in the grant process, and I think we're going to move right on without any issues. They've Juan DeAndre left us well prepared with plenty of information, and so we, while we are anxious to get someone new in as well, but I think we'll proceed.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, members. Michael Rigby, General Counsel for the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner. The legal report begins on page 98, and before I get to that, wanted to share some of our staff changes. Lori Hobbs, who had been with our agency for 14 and a half years, has accepted a position with the Texas Education Agency, the Permanent School Fund. We wish her the best in that. It's a loss for us. We really appreciate her dedication to the agency and her efforts over the years. I know that she's presented many, many rules to this body, and it's certainly a loss for us. I want to express our appreciation to her and the best of wishes in her new position. We have also hired Audrey Spalding. She's right here. She's our new attorney, a recent graduate from Baylor Law School. So is it Go Bears?
Yes.
Okay. So we want to welcome Audrey. As I said, the legal report's on page 98. The first thing on that report is our contested cases before the State Office of Administrative Hearings. We took one case to hearing in June. That's Anson Financial doing business as AFI Mortgage. We are still waiting for a proposal for decision from the administrative law judge at SOA, and we'll be looking forward to that. Moving over to page 100 and 101, there's some litigation update for VIP Finance. This is a case that is pending at SOA, but before we could proceed at SOA, they filed suit in the Dallas County District Court. That case went up on appeal to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals ruled against VIP. The VIP filed a motion for rehearing, which was denied, and they had a deadline of August 9th to file a motion for rehearing en banc. That is, the decision from the Court of Appeals was done by a panel of the Court of Appeals, and the motion for rehearing en banc is for the entire Court of Appeals to rehear that case or to reconsider the matter. They have an update from last week. VIP did file a motion for rehearing en banc, so the court will be considering that motion, and we'll report to you next time about what happened with that. And then another update that's not in your materials that we received last week. We received notice from the Attorney General's office that they have received a request for an Attorney General opinion. This opinion requests an interpretation of Chapter 393. The request itself we've posted on our website, so it's available. If you click on publications, it should be one of the top hyperlinks. You can look at the materials there. It's also posted on the Attorney General's website. We will be sending out an email to the stakeholders for Chapter 393 if they're interested in this issue and want to submit briefs to the Attorney General's office. They can do that. The deadline is September 6th. Wanted to kind of brief you a little bit about what the question involves, just so you can understand the issue. Our agency, the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner, regulates credit access businesses. Credit access businesses do what's commonly called payday loans. It's one of the things that they do. Payday loans are short-term loans. They have very high APRs, frequently triple-digit APRs, kind of unusual for financial services. Chapter 393 authorizes two kinds of activities. One is a credit services organization. which requires that the credit services organization register with the Secretary of State, and the other one is a credit access business, or a CAB. And a CAB is licensed by our agency, and they do two kinds of transactions, a deferred presentment transaction, which is commonly called a payday loan, and a motor vehicle title loan. So two separate things, credit services organization and CABs. In order to be licensed as a CAB, you also have to be registered with the Secretary of State as a credit services organization. CABs have additional requirements under the statute. They have to post their fees, provide consumer disclosures, maintain minimum assets, contribute a TFEE fund that we just talked about, submit themselves to periodic examinations by our exam staff, such as William Purse, who you was presenting earlier, and file quarterly reports of their activities. The AG opinion request has two questions. The first question is, can a credit services organization, that is one that's registered with the Texas Secretary of State, offer or help a consumer obtain an extension of credit in a form other than a deferred presentment transaction or a motor vehicle title loan? Something that's referenced in the second question, which is, can they do it through a signature loan, or one that has no security attached to it? So that's the legal question that's being asked of the AG. Our agency intends to submit a brief on that, and as we said, if there are other interested stakeholders who wish to submit briefs, you can do that through the Attorney General's office, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Since you've been here, have we had other Attorney General's requests for issues?
We had one, I think it was less than 2 years ago. It also dealt with a question involving Chapter 393. The question in that case was had to do with the 180-day limitation in Chapter 393. We submitted briefs in that process. The request itself was withdrawn before an opinion was issued. So we never kind of got an answer to our question, but we did submit a brief and participate in that process. Normally, the Attorney General takes about 6 months to process these requests, consider the briefs, and issue the opinions. However, this particular request requests an expedited response. So it's possible that the Attorney General, after receiving the briefs on September 6th, could more quickly issue an opinion, possibly before your next Finance Commission meeting, although, like I said, the normal process is about a six-month process. Any other questions?
What would happen if the Attorney General's office rules in favor of this request? How would that change the dynamics of the lending model?
It depends on how you define in favor, but
we'll support the request that they could do these signature loans through the 393.
Yeah, so that would it depends on how they write it, but perhaps it could mean in their opinion that a credit services organization, that is one that's registered with the Secretary of State and not licensed by us, could help a consumer obtain an extension of credit in some other form, not a deferred presentment transaction and not a motor vehicle title loan, but through, for example, a signature loan, which is unsecured.
Which would be relevant to a 342F lender or a 342B lender?
Yes, that's kind of the same space. Correct. That the 342 regulated lenders operate in. Any other questions? Okay. If there's no other questions, Deputy General Counsel Matt Nance will be presenting several rules.
Thank you, Michael. Hi, Matt.
Good morning. Matt Nance, Deputy General Counsel, Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner.
I'm going to be discussing our rule actions today, starting with our adoption on item C2 of the agenda. These are rule amendments implementing the licensing and administration provisions of the OCCC's Sunset Bill, HB 1442, and the adoption begins on page 105 of the materials. The Commission voted to publish these rules for comment at its June meeting. This rule action covers the across-the-board changes from the Sunset Bill that apply to our regulated industries generally. There are three main across-the-board sunset issues that these rules deal with. So first, the bulk of the rule amendments clarify license terms, the renewal process, and the expiration date for each of our licenses and registrations, except for pawn shops, which are part of a separate rule adoption that I'll be getting to next. Second, this action would repeal and replace our complaint processing rule, section 82.4, to identify the phases of the complaint process based on sunset recommendations. That includes defining what a complaint is, how we accept complaints, the ways we close complaints, and how a complaint decision can be appealed. And third, this action would amend the rule as section 84.309 to specify the contested case procedure for appealing the denial of a debt cancellation agreement for motor vehicles. We received two official comments on these rules, both from associations representing motor vehicle dealers. Those comments are printed on pages 133 through 140 of the materials. The comments dealt with two issues, the complaint process rule at section 82.4 and the renewal period for motor vehicle licenses in section 84.617. So both comments address the complaint processing rule. In particular, both comments recommended limiting the definition of complaint. One comment suggested removing expressions of dissatisfaction and limiting reporting on issues not within the agency's jurisdiction, while the other comment suggested that a communication should only be considered a complaint if the complainant alleges actual wrongdoing. In reviewing those comments, we didn't believe that the definition of complaint should be limited as the commenters proposed. When a consumer initially files a complaint, they may not know the exact nature of the wrongdoing or be able to articulate, you know, exactly the laws violated or how the agency has jurisdiction. That means we may need to review and process the complaint to determine whether we have jurisdiction and whether there is actual wrongdoing. We believe the best way to address that is to work the issue through the complaint process by taking in the complaint, reviewing it, processing it, rather than saying that something is not a complaint. In the adoption for the complaint rule, we did include a couple changes from the proposal. In response to one of the comments in subsection C2, we're including complaints closed due to lack of a violation in the Consumer Assistance Manager's quarterly review and sampling of closed complaints. We also took some further consideration of the time period for appealing a complaint, for the consumer to appeal a complaint. We extended that from 30 days in the proposal to 90 days in the adoption. The other issue addressed in the comments was the renewal period in section 84.617, the renewal period for motor vehicle licensees. Both commenters recommended moving to a two-year renewal period so that motor vehicle licensees would be renewing once every their licenses once every two years rather than annually, which is the current practice and what was described in the proposal. We are open to considering two-year renewal in the future, but we have some concerns about it. There are some of the same concerns we articulated when we presented our proposal. But our motor vehicle licensees in particular have a lot of turnover with new companies coming into the business every year, a lot of companies going out of business every year. So that can create some communication difficulties when we're trying to communicate with our body of licensees, but some of them might be out of business. Second are the additional system costs to move from our current one-year system that we use for all our licensees and registrants. The different industry segments are staggered throughout the year, but each of them has a one-year renewal or one-year license term and have to renew every year. So there would be additional system costs to move from that one-year system to a two-year system. Based on these concerns, at this time, we believe it's appropriate to maintain annual license renewal for our licensees and registrants, but we're open to considering revisiting the issue to consider two-year renewal in the future.
So, Matt, I'm looking at the preamble on that on page 115.
Okay.
And it's the discussion is on the bottom paragraph of the first column of that thing. And sort of the theme here is that you're open to a two-year period, but then you identify, you sort of describe three reasons why you're not going to do now. And as I look at those three reasons, I don't see how those reasons are cured by the passage of time. And so help me understand how we can be open to a two-year period while identifying three reasons which will always exist.
I can help shed some light,
okay.
Maybe.
Please do. I mean, I may not have articulated that well.
I think it's, they seem somewhat, ongoing kind of concerns that we're going to have to look at on a more long-term basis. But first of all, any kind of move to a two-year requires a longer transition period, and system modifications are going to cost what they're going to cost. I mean, those are going to be, but is there a way to deal with those when there's some other system modification going on? It's still going to have some incremental costs associated with the system. The communication issue is the one that, we're frequently communicating with our licensees is a challenge to keep our licensees to keep their information updated with us. Sometimes you get better familiarity with systems and entities get more comfortable and they continue to communicate. And sometimes with the passage of time, you get better communication, but maybe not. And just we'll have to talk with the industries as are there ways that we can look at ensuring that we maintain better information, that their industries maintain better information with us, that there's an obligation on the licensee to make sure they have current information. But can the stakeholders, help influence that in some way? And do we begin to see some change in the currency of information? Or is there some other way that we have a different communication structure that updates that more regularly? So those are some of the issues that I think, again, they are still, I think, persistent challenges for us as we look forward down the road. But there was just, system modifications alone, I think there's not time to approach this two-year question. At the present time,
are there any consumer downsides to going from a one-year to a two-year license?
If we can't solve the issue of who is currently authorized in business and them maintaining current information, I think definitely consumers can't depend upon the records of the agency. I would to determine whether an appropriate entity is that. In business and licensed.
Yeah. So I'm not proposing a change in this rule, but with respect to the stated openness to go to a two-year program, it seems to me that we need to put some stakes in the ground working, because we've got two trade associations representing you, both want to do this. Mm-hmm. And so if we can identify and assure that there are no fix the potential consumer adverse consequences, it seems to me that we ought to try to move forward with putting a series of timing stakes in the ground about how do we get, what can we expect to do this, because this is something that we ought to be able to do for the industry in the event that we can fix the problems, because we got the two dominant trade associations saying this is what they want to do. So I'd like to see some help here.
So once again, this is primarily used car dealers, right?
No? Both.
Okay.
It's all car dealers.
Car dealers.
So new
and as well as the acceptance companies that take assignment of contracts from the dealers.
Is this not the area we get the most complaints in, we have the most challenges in?
Yes.
I mean, my gut feeling, and that's all it is, gut feeling, is if it's an area that's commonly a challenge for consumers, then it's not an area that we want to loosen up our oversight of those organizations. And I think I agree with what the chairman's saying in a sense, but I would just say strike the words about, you know, we'll consider it a later time. And you're stating the facts why it's not a good idea now, then why not just stick with that rather than officially leaving that door open? They can still bring it up at another time anyway, right? But I think, to me, I agree with you in the fact that you're stating that at some point we'll consider it, but I'm not even sure why you're stating that. I think your case here is we don't think it's a good idea. Here's the reasons. We're not going to do it.
I understand what you're saying.
I don't disagree with you. But it seems to me it's either one or the other, and so my position was, that's why I raised the consumer issues. Let's make sure that the agency who's responsible for, you know, that this is the one agency who has a statutory responsibility to protect consumers. To make sure that anything that they do, if they are open to it, that consumers are protected. And if we're not really open to it, then, you know, I'm a little troubled by this preamble that says we are. So I'm not disagreeing with you. It just seems that we ought to do one or the other. We're not, and I'm not suggesting we do anything other than what this rule says we're going to do now. But, you know, having a set of processes going forward to decide whether we're going to do it or not, rather than just leave these as consistent reasons to not do the change. You know, 2 years from now it comes up again and we still have the same changes. Depends on how strong the industry feels about it. I'm not suggesting any changes.
If I can just say, I do think, you know, we are, if it's an administrative issue, we see some challenges with it, but, you know, I understand that there's a great desire on the parts of some of the industry members to do this. We felt like it's not something we've had enough opportunity to study fully. And again, I've said out there that we're open to it. We are, but I think we need to take on, and we're willing to take on some of those conversations and maybe determine either it's on or it's off for good. But it certainly it's premature for this document. And you know, our reasons may stand, but I felt like we needed to spend some more. We may ultimately need to spend some more time
And
discussing it.
Does it need to state in this document that we're open to it?
It doesn't need to, but we were just trying to indicate that we weren't foreclosing it forever.
Well,
I'm not used to seeing that kind of phraseology in any of these.
Doesn't it arrive from what we got from? Did Sunset say something about this or not?
It did. Sunset said that's an option that we could do up to 2-year renewals, and some agencies do that. So, yes, it did.
And you know, so the idea is Texas is a business-friendly state, right? So if there's some way to make it more friendly to the industry, that's also something we ought to think about doing. So let me suggest that we do this. Karen, if y'all would undertake to... You know, if you're concerned, if you'll have dialogue with the commissioner and the staff on this issue, I would appreciate it.
That's great, happy to. And of course, the comments that
Could you state your?
Karen Phillips with the Texas Automobile Dealers Association, representing franchise dealers. And as you noticed in my comments were to perhaps have a proposal whereby it didn't foreclose.
Could you come forward to the microphone, please? It's being recorded and
Sorry, thank you.
That's fine, Dad.
And you get the good chair.
It's great to have the good chair. Again, Karen Phillips with TADA. And as you notice, my comments didn't foreclose, and we're suggesting that the rule not foreclose a 2-year renewal. It simply said, let's just not say it has to be 1 year or annually. Let's allow the rule itself to give the agency the option of having that 2-year renewal. Mm-hmm. So that was the proposal that TADA made, so that you didn't have to come back in case you decided to do a 2-year. You didn't have to come back and re-propose the rule. the rule itself would take care of that, and it would give the option to the agency to have a one-year annual or a biennial, just like we do at the Texas Department of Motor Vehicles, which is a two-year license. So that was TADA's comments with respect to the renewal issue, so that you didn't have to come back and re-propose and have for public comment. That was our concern. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry for the interruption.
No, that's all right. I did want to note, we did review that comment. We considered the possibility of the rule leaving open the period. In taking a look at the sunset bill, though, section 14.112, and we explain this on page 115 of the preamble, but section 14.112 states the Finance Commission by rule shall prescribe the licensing or registration period. So we believed it was appropriate for that period to be specified in the rule, given that text. And I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any others on this adopted rule action.
Are we ready to go to the motion?
Yes. If there are no questions, we recommend the commission vote to adopt these rule changes.
Do I hear a motion to approve proposal and publication for comment of the amendments? This time, the...
Do we have a motion?
No, we don't. This time, the Finance Commission will take a three-minute break. The time is 9:34. 51 of the government code. The time is 9:38 a.m. Okay. All right. As soon as we reconvene, somebody can chase down some members, that would be good.
Oh, yeah.
I'm
hearing some comments about spelling. Hanging out.
Just a long 3 months.
All right, members, we are on the OCC Section 3, Item 2. Do I hear a motion that we approve on final adoption the amendments to new rules and repeal and 7 TAC Part 1, Chapter 2, and Part 5, Chapters 82, 83, 84, 85, 86, 87, 88, and 89.
So moved.
I have a motion by Philip.
Second.
Second by Laurie. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion passes.
Okay, next I'll be discussing item C3 on the agenda. These are rule amendments implementing the pawn shop provisions of the OCCC Sunset Bill, HB 1442. The adoption begins on page 141 of the materials. The commission voted to publish these rules for comment at its June meeting. These rule amendments relate mainly to four pawn shop-related issues from the Sunset Bill. First, the Sunset Bill makes pawn shop employee licensing optional at the option of the pawn shop. The rules would implement the pawn shop employee license program by adding references and specifying that rules for pawn shop employees apply when the pawn shop participates in the pawn shop employee license program. Second, the rule at section 85306 would amend the pawn shop employee fees to $50 for a new license and $25 for a renewal to help ensure that the fees compensate the agency for the costs of the program. Third, the rule at section 85104 would clarify license terms, renewal, and expiration while maintaining the current annual renewal and June 30th expiration date. And fourth, the amendments would remove the phrase good moral character from the licensing rules based on a sunset recommendation that was a subjective standard, while still explaining that we'd review an applicant's character and fitness, which includes criminal history. The OCCC received one official comment on this proposal. It was from the Texas Association of Pawnbrokers, and it's on page 156 of the materials. The association recommended that pawn shops be allowed to indicate their participation in the pawn shop employee license program by clicking a checkbox in the OCCC's online licensing system. We agree with that concept that pawn shops should be able to indicate their participation using the online system. The rule text says that pawn shops indicate participation by providing written notification. That text is based on the Sunset Bill, which also talks about the pawn shop providing written notification to participate. We believe the rule text appropriately mirrors the statute and that designating a choice through the online system would be a type of written notification. By the end of the calendar year, we plan to implement a system change to allow pawn shops to designate their choice through the online system. And before we implement that, we plan to allow pawn shops to provide their notification by email or mail. So those are the rule changes presented for adoption, and I'm happy to answer any questions about those.
Questions for Matt?
I do have one question,
yes.
And I'm sorry. I know I've asked this question before, so I'm going to repeat myself.
Okay.
Apologize for that in advance. So if they choose to opt out of the agency, you know, monitoring the pawn shop employee, which
mm-hmm.
I know you're looking at character and fitness, and the pawn shop is just directly responsible for them, then it's up to the pawn shop owner as to whatever they choose to investigate as far as character and fitness.
Yes, that's correct. The pawn shop, you know, would be responsible for the violations of its employees. So that's what our rule said previously, and we're reaffirming that. That was another part of the Sunset Bill. So, yes, that responsibility is on the pawn shop.
I may have asked this question before, but I'm not going to apologize. So if a pawn shop has 10 employees, can you decide to have our AC license 5 of them and 5 of them not? It's either all or none.
It's either all or none. The pawn shop has either opted into the program or
okay.
not. If they have opted in, then each of their employees who write transactions and who would have been required under the previous law to be licensed would need to get a license with this agency.
And I don't suppose the pawn shop has to post whether or not they've had this agency license their employees or not for the consumer to know.
No, there's no requirement.
So this is transparent to the consumer.
Yeah, currently there's no requirement in the Sunset Bill to post whether they're participating in the program.
Hi, Marianne Diamond, Director of Licensing and Registration Office of Consumer Credit. So as we modify the system, we are adding a portion to the external facing database that anyone can search, and we'll see whether a pawn shop has opted in or opted out to pawn employee licensing.
Okay.
And typically in many shops you'll see their licenses also posted on the bulletin board or something for public viewing.
Mm-hmm. But to your specific question, there is no designation when you walk into the for the public to understand whether they're opted in or opted out.
Yeah, and I think I was getting to where, and I should ask this in our last meeting, but didn't strike me that we're making a change, but the consumer's not aware of the change, and they're not aware of either the risk or the not risk. So it's a comment.
I do, just based upon some of the comments during the legislative process, I do think that there are some pawn shops that may intend to use that information as marketed in some way if their employees are licensed. Mm. But.
Okay. Thank you.
And if there are no other questions, we recommend that the commission vote to adopt these rule amendments.
Members, do I hear a motion that we approve on final adoption the amendments to 7 TAC Chapter 85, Subchapter A?
So moved.
I have a motion by Cliff. I have a second by Philip. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes.
Okay, so next I'll be discussing 4 rule proposals that would implement 2019 legislation. These begin with item C4, starting on page 157. These particular rules in C4 would implement changes related to the single equivalent daily rate for regulated loans based on HB 3855 that the Texas legislature passed in the most recent session. Chapter 342 of the Finance Code describes several rate structures for regulated consumer loans, and one of the authorized rate structures is a 3-tiered rate, where the lender can charge 30% on part of the loan amount, 24% on another part, and 18% on another part. HB 3855 allows a lender to use a single equivalent daily rate as an alternative to applying the rate to each bracket of the 3-tiered rate. This helps simplify the calculations for the lender and also simplifies how the rate is disclosed to the borrower. These proposed rule amendments would implement HB 3855's authorization to use a single equivalent daily rate. The rule amendments at section 83501 would specify that the method is allowed, and the rule amendments at section 90.203 would include model clauses that lenders can use for plain language contracts. As far as the process goes, we distributed a pre-comment draft of these rule amendments to stakeholders and held an in-person stakeholder meeting and webinar in July where we got feedback from stakeholders. We got some feedback at the stakeholder meeting and received one informal pre-comment. The pre-comment recommended including specific language in the model clauses referring to the single equivalent daily rate. So based on that pre-comment, we included a sentence in our model clauses referring to the single equivalent rate. As we explained in the stakeholder meeting, we're considering and planning to issue an advisory bulletin with a calculation example showing how deriving and calculating this single rate works. And the pre-comment we received supported issuing that bulletin. So those are the proposed amendments for single equivalent daily rate. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Matt? If we had a chalkboard, we could let you calculate it so we can see how it's done.
I would have to defer to.
We try to keep lawyers away from numbers.
That's, yeah. And if not, we recommend that the commission vote to publish these amendments for comment.
Do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment of amendments to section 83.501 in 7 TAC Part 5, Chapter 83, Subchapter A, concerning rules for regulated lenders, and to section 90.203 and 7 TAC Part 5, Chapter 90, concerning Chapter 342, plain language contract provisions.
Make the motion.
I have a motion from Molly.
Second.
I have a second from Will. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes. Yep.
Okay. Next, I'll be discussing item C5, starting on page 165. These rules implement changes related to the documentary fee for motorcycles based on HB 3171. Chapter 345 of the Finance Code governs retail installment contracts to purchase goods on credit. For certain types of vehicles like motorcycles, boats, and ATVs, Chapter 345 allows the seller to charge a documentary fee or doc fee to compensate the seller for processing documents. HB 3171 amends various provisions in the Texas Transportation Code and the Finance Code to change classification for mopeds and motorcycles. Generally, this bill was intended to simplify the driver's license that someone needs to get when they're driving a moped. But one of the effects of that was to go in and change some of the definitions and to remove the term motor-driven cycle from the Transportation Code and also remove that term from the Finance Code provisions on the doc fee for motorcycles. These proposed rule amendments would implement HB 3171 by removing the obsolete term motor-driven cycle from the doc fee rule at section 86201. The amendments don't change the amounts that sellers can charge. They simply remove that obsolete term to conform to the statute. As with the single equivalent rate proposal, we distributed a pre-comment draft of these rule amendments to stakeholders. We discussed this rule at our July stakeholder meeting and webinar, and we didn't receive any pre-comments on these rule amendments. So I'm happy to answer any questions about these amendments.
Questions for Matt?
So when you remove the term motor-driven cycle, what do you replace it with?
Right. So under the previous law, there was this general term motorcycle, and then motor-driven cycles were a subset of that, and then mopeds were a subset of that. And this bill kind of changed it so that motorcycles and mopeds are now two different things, but essentially occupying the same space of vehicles. And these are vehicles that, you know, have a saddle that you sit on and are operated with a motor. These aren't like the scooters that you stand up on. But so it's my understanding that the vehicles that would have been considered motor-driven cycles under the previous law are now going to be either motorcycles or mopeds under the new law, and are going to cover that kind of universe of saddle-equipped vehicles that you're riding on.
With a motor.
Yeah.
With a motor.
Yeah, with a motor. Yeah.
Of some size.
Yeah.
There's no designation of the motor size CCs or anything like that.
If that may indicate the difference between a motorcycle
Correct.
And a moped.
Yeah.
And then that affects the need for the Class M license, but
right.
that is kind of more of an issue for Department of Public Safety and
DMV.
Department of Motor Vehicles.
Yeah. Okay.
Our rule is just about the doc fee.
Understood.
And you know, trying to make sure that our doc fee rule conforms to that statutory change.
I withdraw my question.
It is. These classifications are, I was surprised at how complex they were because it depends on a lot of things. But anyway.
Other questions for Matt? Matt, I have a question for you.
Okay.
Given my age and heft, my friends in the cycling community have suggested I get an electric bicycle rather than the regular bicycle that I am. And when I look at the definition of motor-driven cycle, it contained an exclusion for electric bicycles. So what's the story on electric bicycles?
Are you concerned about whether or not you have to pay a doc fee?
Yeah. I'm trying to find out if, you know, what's happened to
and it's funny you should mention that because I have an electric bike. I really enjoy it in some of the hills in Austin.
And
it's really
helpful.
Age
of the heft.
Yeah. But so my memory, I and I apologize, I don't have the specific section, but my memory was that there were other provisions that excluded electric bicycles, but I don't remember the citation off the top of my head. The basic, I think the idea of the dock fee was to allow a dock fee for goods that have to be titled or registered through a DMV system, and because those are the ones that involve processing, you know, titling and registration documents. So, yeah, it's my understanding that electric bikes aren't subject to that.
Well, perhaps when we come back for the final order, you can illuminate me about that.
Okay. Okay. I'll try to see what I can find out about that between now and October.
Thank you.
Any other questions? And if not, we recommend that the commission vote to publish these rules for comment.
There are here motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment of amendments to section 86.201 in 7 TAC Part 5, Chapter 86, concerning retail creditors.
So moved.
I have a motion from Stacy.
Second.
I have a second from Laurie. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. Motion carries.
So we have two more proposals. Next, I'll be discussing item C6, starting on page 169. This is a new rule relating to military licensing for residential mortgage loan originators, implementing SB 1200 that the legislature passed in 2019, as well as Chapter 55 of the Texas Occupations Code. This is similar to the rules that Devin was discussing earlier for the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending. So as Devin mentioned, Chapter 55 of the Occupations Code has military licensing requirements for military service members, veterans, and spouses. SB 1200 amended Chapter 55 to include temporary authority for military spouses to do business in Texas if licensed in another jurisdiction. Chapter 55 also has some other provisions, like an exemption from fees and penalties for late renewal, an expedited license process, and crediting of service toward license requirements. Chapter 55 applies to licenses that must be obtained by individuals. So the OCCC issues a few different license types, many that have to be obtained by the business entity entering the transaction, but we have two license types that have to be obtained by specifically individuals, and those are residential mortgage loan originator licenses and pawn shop employee licenses. That's why we have a rule proposal for, excuse me, RMLOs and one for pawn shop employees. So this proposed rule for the RMLOs explains the temporary authorization for military spouses, the exemption from fees and penalties for late renewal, the expedited license process, and crediting toward employment history. Because RMLO licensing is nationwide with similar requirements across jurisdictions, the rule explains that we'll consider an RMLO license received in accordance with the federal nationwide program to be a substantially equivalent license to the Texas license. Regarding process, as with our other proposals, we distributed a pre-comment draft of this new rule to stakeholders. We discussed the rule at our July stakeholder meeting and webinar, and we did not receive any pre-comments. So I'm happy to answer any questions on this proposal.
Questions for Matt?
And if not, we recommend the commission vote to publish this new rule for comment.
Do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment of new section 2.107 in 7 TAC Part 1, Chapter 2, concerning residential mortgage loan originators? Motion by Will.
Did
I get it wrong?
2.108.
Misstated. Okay. Do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment of new section 2.108 in 7 TAC Part 1, Chapter 2, concerning residential mortgage loan originators.
So moved.
I have a motion by Vince.
Second.
I have a second by Will. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion carries.
Okay, and the last of our rule proposals, item C7, starting on page 173. This is a new rule relating to military licensing for pawn shop employees based on SB 1200 and Chapter 55 of the Texas Occupations Code. So similar to our other pawn shop employee rules, this would apply only to employees of pawn shops that have opted into the pawn shop employee license program. As with the RMLO rule I just presented, this rule for pawn shop employees explains temporary authority for military spouses, exemption from fees and penalties for late renewal, expedited license processing, and crediting of service toward employment history. Unlike with RMLOs, we're not aware of other jurisdictions that have pawn shop employee licensing requirements substantially equivalent to Texas. We are inviting comment from stakeholders on that issue if they're aware of that. If a pawn shop employee wanted to assert the temporary authorization under this rule, the rule would require them to notify us, state what jurisdiction they're licensed in, so we can determine whether that other jurisdiction's requirements are substantially equivalent. As with our other proposals, we distributed a pre-comment draft of this new rule to stakeholders. We discussed this rule at our July stakeholder meeting and webinar. We didn't receive any pre-comments, but we did get some feedback at the stakeholder meeting from pawn shops requesting that the license application include questions about whether the applicant is a military service member, veteran, or spouse, and we do intend to incorporate that into the license application. In reviewing this rule action, I noticed a typo on page 175 at the bottom of the second column. There's a reference to Texas Finance Code Chapter 180. That should be Chapter 371. We will fix that before we send this to the Texas Register.
Say the chapter again.
It should be Chapter 180 should be Chapter 371.
Got it.
I'm happy to answer any questions on this proposed new rule.
Questions for Matt? Do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment of new Section 85.309 in 7 TAC Part 5, Chapter 85, Subchapter A, concerning rules of operation for pawn shops?
So moved.
I have a motion by Philip.
Second.
I have a second by Stacy. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That concludes our report.
Thank you. Leslie, at this time, the Finance Commission will take a 10-minute break. But before I do that, the record should reflect that Molly Curl is going to leave the meeting, and so her absence from this meeting should be noted. Now, at this time, the Finance Commission will take a 10-minute break. The time is 10:03 a.m. 51 of the Government Code. The time is 10:13 a.m. Commissioner Cooper.
Thank you. So the Department of Banking starts on 181. I'd like to make up some very brief general comments, though. We've had several retirements that will be effective at the end of this month that I would just like to mention. As all of you know, Stephanie Newberg is retiring, and in fact, she's effectively gone. Joe Bros, our head of IT, will also retire at the end of the month, along with Bobby Davenport, who is our regional director in Houston. All these folks have been with the agency for a long time. For instance, Bobby has been with the department for a mere 34 years. So all of these folks are good people. We're going to miss them, but it's nice to know that we have some really good people in the wings. Also, I'd like to mention some new positions. So as previously announced just recently, Russell Reese, Mr. Reese, stand up back in the background, has been promoted to Assistant Deputy Commissioner. And Russell,
I don't know about that.
No comments, Russell. Russell will be overseeing all of the special audits area. He's been the director of that area, but he's now going to be elevated, and he'll be helping me work on some issues. And his position, Russell, has it been posted yet?
We're waiting for your final approval.
Okay, waiting on me. All right, so that'll be posted very shortly, probably this afternoon. I have also created a new position called Chief Operating Officer. I kind of brought that over, I think, from the private sector. And so we will be posting that position, but in the interim, until posted and filled, Wendy Rodriguez is serving in that capacity. Joe's position, Joe Brose's position, will be posted. We're working with the Department of Information Resources to work with the posting and the filling of that position. Bobby's position, Bobby Davenport's position, has been posted and has been filled, and that announcement will be made to the Houston personnel this afternoon. So, again, a lot of good people here, but you talk about management succession. I guess you really don't know if you've got it until you need it. And we have got, on these positions, we have got some really good people that are in the wings, so to speak. So I feel good about that. On page 181, the recap of our bank and trust activity, top right-hand corner, we're down to 281 banks. But as you can see, the assets of those banks continue to increase. So we're at $271 billion in assets. Those banks have $271 billion in assets. Down at the bottom, kind of the barometer of the health of the industry, out of those 228 banks, only seven of those are considered problems. And they are at the light level, if you will, of the problem area. So Dr. Armstrong, as a reference, during the recession, that number was 58. So we're down to seven. You see down at the bottom that we expect that number to be somewhere bouncing around from the 3% to the 5% amount. And that's just kind of the way it has been for history. There's always some banks in that area, but that number, those banks don't stay there very long. It's kind of in and out. If we do our job right and they do their job right, we're in and out. Then beyond that, 182 at the top of the page would be our enforcement actions. As you see, that number, reading left to right, that number's down to 22. And all of those, all but two of those actions are considered informal. So as the number of problem bikes go down, the enforcement actions also go down. We have met all of our examination performance measures, and I'll discuss the trust activity here in just a little bit. On page 183, the agency did put out some guidance on the cannabis-related activity to make sure that our banks knew a little bit about how to deal with that since this CBD oil is now legal, and they need to know how to deal with that. Also, just to point out, review examiner Michelle Hodge is an instructor at the Graduate School of Banking. I believe she's there this week, so it shows that the quality of our personnel. Beginning on page 184, we have the summary of...
Could you enlighten me a little bit how the legalization is hemp, right?
Yeah.
How that would affect banks?
Well, they need to know how to... some of the guidance, or actually some of the regulation, has not been fully evolved through a couple of departments. And so we let, in the guidance, we let the banks know what we felt like they could do and probably couldn't do until certain, some of this guidance, excuse me, some of this regulation came out. So, for
but
instance,
they couldn't do in relationship to the
to financing. I'm sorry, financing.
Taking
deposits.
Or even
deposits. So, for as an example, retail hemp oil, if under the certain amounts, can be sold right now and can be financed right now. But you have to be within these guidelines, and I think there are two agencies still have to come out with regulations. So it's still in process. We had a lot of questions. We work with the trade groups to come out with this guidance. On page 184 would be the corporate division activities. On page 185, as Caroline mentioned, we have a application from Next Bank to convert to a state commercial bank. They are approximately $8.5 billion. We also have another application in process from Interstate Bank in Perryton. So we have two conversion applications that we're working on as we speak. Then right under that, one of our banks, Fidelity Bank in Wichita Falls, merged into a national bank. So by number of accounts, we're down one. We did have a de novo exempt trust company that we granted a charter to. On page 186 will be the special audit summary. Again, a lot of data here. It goes over on the left-hand side, you know, what the industry is, such as money service businesses, prepaid funeral contracts, et cetera, the number of exams completed, and then kind of down close to the bottom, it talks about the ratings of these various agencies, entities, and as you can see, all of these things are rated relatively well. It's improved, and so to me, this is kind of shows the barometer of the condition of the industry. The industries in this grouping are doing very well. And then on 187, there's a lot of detail at the top of the page about our compliance with examination priorities, where we are, how many days past due on some of them. But the punchline is that at the end of the day, end of the year, we expect to be meeting our performance measures. On page 188 would be the staffing report. This was the same report, the same date presented last meeting. So unless there's questions, I'm not going to go into detail there. On page 189, each agency's talked about our performance measures as of the third quarter, and that these are ours. I'd like to point out, for instance, the item two, trust / IT examinations performed, you will see that we're doing very well there, but the fourth quarter we expect to have some problems. We've had some staffing shortages, and we're trying to fill that, but fourth quarter is going to be pretty tough in the trust area. Then on the, down at the very bottom on application processing, as Molly questioned earlier, our number of filings are greater than expected, so but it's just a reference point. Page 190 talks about the strategic support division on the complaints, and it's this information is relatively consistent from the previous presentations. I think Wendy kind of said that the complaint activity has kind of calmed down a little bit, and probably is, I think that happens in good times, if you will, and maybe picks up when times aren't quite as good. So that may be an economic barometer to some degree. On page 193, I'd like to point out that Wendy Rodriguez at the 2019 Financial Literacy Summit, which is an annual event in Irving. Wendy gave the opening remarks of that summit, so we appreciate her doing that. On 194, I just wanted to mention that we are doing a conference. Our staff is doing a conference in Sugar Land in September. We try to have a conference where all personnel attends at least every 18 months. So we're doing that one, and we found, I think, a really good location to do it. Good facilities at reasonable prices. So that is a quick summary of our report. Any questions on that before I ask Catherine Ryer to come up?
Just a comment, Commissioner Cooper. I just want to thank all three agencies for doing a great job with developing the bench, because as these retirements come along, you have the team in place to step forward, and I think that's a tremendous asset that y'all provided for us.
Thank you. I also state that in this budget period, Sammy Chadley mentioned it yesterday in the presentation, it was truly a team effort. And so our directors really all came together, and it wasn't painless, but we got to the end zone at the appropriate time. Thank you. Catherine?
Good morning, members. The legal division update begins on page 195 in the packet, and I have some good news about the three deaf care cases that I've been talking to you about. The first one, which involved an unlicensed seller of a prepaid funeral benefits contract, we did reach an agreement, and they've agreed to pay restitution to the purchaser and a $2,000 administrative penalty to the agency. So that is one bit of good news. The second bit of good news is Oliver Lomax, who is a licensed funeral provider. Similarly, we've reached an agreement with him. He's agreed to pay restitution for the overcharges and also a penalty to the agency. And finally, Ms. Hernandez, Hernandez Funeral Home, another licensed entity with us, we had issued a cease and desist order based on some suspicious cancellation activity. They had requested a hearing on that cease and desist order. They've retained counsel, which is a good thing, and we've been in negotiations. They've withdrawn their request for a hearing, so we're attempting to resolve that informally as well. On the next page, this is an interesting matter. So we have an enforcement action against a currency exchange operator. Don't want to get into too much detail with you because in addition to our contested case matter, which is pending before our contracted administrative law judge, that entity has filed suit against the agency in Travis County District Court. And the nature of that suit is to challenge our appointment of the contracted administrative law judge to hear the matter. So it's a very interesting topic for us, and we think we are absolutely authorized to do this. It's in statute. We have retained counsel through the Office of the Attorney General to represent us in that suit. So that is ongoing. Really, those are the main highlights that I wanted to bring to your attention, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
If I could, let me mention under the gifts on page 196, $76,000 from the Conference of State Bank Supervisors to pay for some of our examiners to attend IT training. I mentioned this earlier, that this is something that CSBS agreed to do and pay for this training, including lodging. And so we are taking advantage of it, and I hope by the end of this year that all of our examiners will have participated in that training program. We okay, ready to go into the rules?
Yes. So the first rule action, all three of these rule actions are coming out of sunset recommendations and SB 614, which was the sunset bill that was passed that continued our agency and the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending. That bill included two of the actions, two of the rule actions before you are coming out of that. One, the first one, I guess I'll just jump right into it, and this is on page 222 in your packet is the first. So this is item six. Yeah, so we're skipping past the consent items, consent agenda items. We're now on agenda item six, and it begins on page 222 of your packet. And this has to do with private child support enforcement agencies. So prior to the new legislation, we registered private child support enforcement agencies. We had about 10 of them registered with us. We did not have any real significant oversight of these entities. It was really merely a registration, but there was, along with that registration requirement, there was kind of a whole slew of rules that were adopted to implement the registration process. So based on the Senate bill, SB 614, that was passed to continue our agencies, they decided to remove that registration requirement. So these entities are no longer going to be required to be registered with our agency. So this first rule action is to repeal that section of the rules that concerned the registrations for those entities. So it's a very straightforward rule action. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Kevin?
Just describe briefly for me the type of business this is.
So these are private child support enforcement agencies. These are private companies that contract with individuals who are seeking enforcement of child support orders. So the lion's share of people that are seeking to get those orders enforced go through the Attorney General's office, but people have the option to retain a private company to do that work for them. And so there are companies that do this work. They enter into contracts, and they may be contingency agreements, but basically those entities, those private companies, were required previously, before this bill was passed, they were required to register with our agency.
Thank you.
Other questions? Do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment of repeal of 7 TAC Chapter 31, Part 2, subsections 31.1 through 31.115 concerning private child support enforcement agencies?
So moved.
I have a motion by Cliff.
Second.
I have a second by Stacy. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it. Motion carries.
Thank you. The next two items are, these are items that came out of recent legislation, but these were not actually in our sunset bill, so I'm sorry I misled you earlier. These two actions came out of a bill that was put forward by the Office of the Comptroller of Public Accounts. So you may recall that a couple sessions ago, the Comptroller's Office established the Texas Bullion Depository, and as part of that legislation, in 2017, they established clarified the requirements for the Bullion Depository agents. So these were going to be agents that would accept deposits of precious metals to go into the depository. In that earlier legislation, the legislature had asked our agency to be the agency that would license those entities that would function as the depository agents. In the most recent session, that part of the legislation was deleted. So there are no longer going to be any depository bullion depository agents. So the goal, and I'm a little hesitant to speak toward it because it wasn't our bill, and we were just standing on the sidelines watching as this played out. But my personal understanding is that they wanted to make the depository more accessible and make it easier for individuals to give their bullion to or precious metals to entities that would then take it to the depository. So as part of that, they've just essentially removed the whole licensing scheme for these agents. So we had previously come to you, and you had previously adopted rules that would essentially make them a type of money service business. So for those of you who have been on the commission for a while, you may remember that, you know, as agents that are required to be licensed as money service businesses have multiple requirements. There's a security requirement, there's a net worth requirement, there's character and fitness, there's significant licensing fees and examinations. There's a very robust regulatory scheme in place. We had brought these depository agents in as part of that scheme. So the next two actions before you, the first one is to just repeal those specific rules that only deal with the depository agents. The next one, which I will present as a separate item, but just to let you know how they fit together, the next one is to amend just those portions of our rules that deal with money services businesses generally, and then we had added language specifically dealing with the depository agents. So it's a little confusing, but per Texas Register, we had to do it as two separate actions. This one is the repeal, and the next one I'll talk about will be just the amendments deleting those portions of the rules. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Catherine? Catherine, do we have any licensed bullion depository agents?
No. We have never received a single application. We've had a couple of calls, is my understanding, just some very high-level passing interest, but we've never received an application.
Any other questions? Do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment of repeal of 7 PAC Chapter 33, Part 2, Section 33.71 to 33.75, concerning bullion depository agents?
So moved.
I have a motion from Stacy.
Second.
I have a second from Philip. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion carries.
Thank you. And the final rule before you is to amend those rules that had references to the depository agents. So, again, these rules deal with the overall licensing scheme for money service businesses. But we've now gone through and deleted all of the references that were sort of interwoven into those rules. Happy to answer any questions about those.
Questions for Catherine? Do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment of amendments to 7 TAC Chapter 33, Part 2, subsections 33.1, 33.13, 33.15, 33.27, and 33.51 concerning bullion depository agents?
I see a...
33.1.
Yeah, I think the first section that's seeking to be amended is 33.3.
Yeah.
I think you said 33.1.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it. My bad. Let me do it over. So with that change, do I hear a motion... from Philip. Do I have a second?
Second.
Second from Stacy. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any executive session matters?
No, but we do have one thing about the building. You wanted an update on the building.
Okay.
Which is item 8 on the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Karen, John, you want to bring them up to date?
Is there, there's not a page number. Right.
Okay,
no,
this is a public session matter we're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure. So, just by the way of a little history, just going back to our efforts related to securing new headquarters location, in fact, the session before last, there was an amendment in a particular piece of legislation that gave the financial regulatory agencies the option to purchase any excess property that might be available at the Camp Hubbard site once the Department of Transportation has consolidated their campus and the Department of Motor Vehicles has determined there are needs associated with that. And so to kind of update you, kind of the dominoes in that chain, so the Department of Transportation continues to work on their project for campus consolidation. They purchased new land in March of 2017. Well, they got the authority to purchase the land in March of 2017. They actually purchased land for their new campus in August of 2017. In May of 2017, they got an appropriation for some development cost and developed the site. Fast forward now to 19, they've got some appropriation authority. They are planning to begin construction on that site on October the 10th, is my understanding. Their forecast to complete that construction is the end of 2021, and they intend to move in early 2022. That's the best information I have related to that. We do have meetings scheduled with them next week to kind of be sure we get that information is clear, that we're clear about their time frames, and to begin continue conversations with them about part of the property at Camp Hubbard where they reside and will ultimately, we believe, be vacating. Then, secondarily, the Department of Motor Vehicles, there was quite a bit of legislation regarding, or discussion during the legislative process regarding driver licenses and the administration of the driver's license program. Right now that's housed at DPS. Whether or not that may transfer the Department of Motor Vehicles, it appears is quite possible. There's some transition plans they're all working on. But nonetheless, we engaged in some space planning exercises with them over the last, I'd say, during calendar year 2018. As we looked at space opportunities on that property, it appears there will be sufficient additional space for the financial regulatory agencies. So we are continuing that process to see if that's feasible. So, anything else you want to add, Commissioner Cooper?
No, other than to reiterate, we have a statutory opportunity to purchase. We have the right to purchase, but not the obligation. And I think that's a huge step. It is what we termed it a legacy property. It's something that we would really. It's a great location, a great piece of property, exactly where we need to be. We decided when we started down that road that unless we could find something that would be better, that we would set our goals on that. We continue to have our real estate company that represents us go out in the market. In fact, we had one piece of property that we're supposed to be looking at. We're very familiar with it. But it would have to be something, I think, fairly we would really have to like everything about it for us to move from the course of the Camp Hubbard property. But we will be pursuing that.
Is there any other interested parties other than us looking at that Camp Hubbard property, other state?
There will be, or they would be, but we have the first right of refusal, okay. If you will. We have not negotiated the purchase price, but back in the beginning when we got the bill passed, it was clear, we made it clear in the governor's office was there that we were not, we were unable to pay retail for that because it's a great location, but they don't want retail there. We're the perfect candidate to move in because the neighbors don't want, you know, high density retail.
Anything else?
That's it.
Members, anything?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
I'd just like to say that we talked about retirements. I'm going to look forward to working with Russell. He has a nice smile, so we'll go from there. I know that on my orientation, that my first interaction was with Stephanie. And you were out of town, so she substituted for you. And that was just a great first impression of this commission. I always enjoyed all of her smiles, all of her quick answers, knowing everything. She seemed to could answer any question, but she could always do it with a smile. That goes a long way today. I'm saddened by the fact she's not here today, that we can say bye to her. But I hope, and I know you will, Commissioner, you will pass on great and sincere thanks for her service to this commission, and I know for myself.
Thank you so much.
Commissioner Puente moves that we give the Deputy Commissioner a round of applause.
Absolutely.
There being no further business, this meeting of the Finance Commission is now adjourned. The time is 10:46 a.m.